This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Jeremiah Jarte, filling in for your usual host, Mr. Joel Hilliker. And with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And Mihailo Zekic.
Hello.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
It's good to be with you.
We have a lot to get to today, and we'll start with a story that has been a long time in the making, and that is that the United Kingdom has agreed on a deal with the European Union that will finally close the book on more than 4 years of uncertainty about Brexit. For this, we'll turn to our man right there in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, it's a bit of an unreality. Like you say, we've been talking about this for so long. And we may finally be putting it to bed. In the words of Nigel Farage, the UKIP leader who has pushed so hard for so many decades, really, for Britain to come out of the European Union, the war is over. That's completely true. We'll come back to that a bit later. But still, it seems like a pretty momentous day. So 2 days ago, that would be Wednesday. It seemed late Wednesday night, Britain and the EU came very close to a deal. Actually, it was while I was doing the Trumpet Daily, all of these reports started coming out that actually a deal looked like it was going to be struck. They were going to announce that at 7 a.m. yesterday morning, then it was going to be 10 a.m., then it was at some point in the afternoon. It's no surprises on this thing that's been delayed 4 years that the announcement was delayed again and again. But then finally they announced this deal that they've come to. And on the surface, it looks very positive for Britain. The general consensus so far among people like Nigel Farage and the pro-Brexiteers seem to be a good deal, not perfect, but a good deal. I think the massive caveat on all of this is the deal was published yesterday afternoon. Most of the world, or at least most of Europe, is celebrating Christmas Day today. So nobody has really dug into the details. We haven't heard back yet from lawyers or international trade experts or anybody like that going over the details. And the EU is very good at slipping things into the details, slipping potentially surprises in there and things like that. So we don't have, I don't think, a great idea of what's in this hundreds of page long trade deal yet. But at least in terms of how it is being presented from both sides, it's looking pretty positive.
What can you tell us about why it took so long to strike this deal, and maybe what aspects of Brexit have led to some of the biggest disagreements between the UK and the EU?
Well, I think there's two aspects to why it took so long, one within the UK and one outside of it. And the first is that the British establishment, I guess you could say the British deep state, has been very anti-Brexit. And so immediately after the referendum, they fought very hard to stop Brexit, to reverse it, to have a second referendum, something like that. And then they began fighting to have really, a Brexit in name only, some kind of a Brexit deal that, yes, on paper, Britain would no longer be a part of the European Union, but de facto, we'd still be under EU laws. We'd still be under EU rules. We'd still be subject to EU judges. We'd still be part of the single market. Basically, everything would keep on going as it was before. So they've been working to almost frustrate negotiations, to slow things down, to give it a chance for a second referendum. They think the more time passes, they think the better the chance they would have, all of these kind of things. And so that internal effort has really delayed things. And those people that have been trying that have been very negative about this deal. That's probably one of the best signs that it is, in fact, quite a positive deal. So there's that. And then there's just the aspect that I covered when we talked about this either last Friday or the Friday before that, where there's the European Union just almost by its nature is this imperialistic power. It doesn't want to let go. It doesn't want to give up power. If it's going to have some kind of a Brexit deal that gives up power, then it's going to have to be forced to do that. And so I think it did take Britain fighting to the bitter end to enable that to happen.
So is this a done deal at this point, or does it still have to be formalized and passed by various government bodies to be official?
Yes, it still needs to be formalized and things like that, but it looks very likely to go through that process. So within the United Kingdom, the Labour Party, the main left-wing party, have said that they will support the deal. So it's got bipartisan support, so it seems very likely to go through both chambers of parliament, be approved from Britain. The European Parliament, I think, has to retroact it. Britain's Parliament has to do that by the end of the year. They'll be having emergency sessions and that kind of thing to get it done. Europe's Parliament can meet retroactively to approve it. But you know, as the most democratic chamber of the European government, they have the least power. So it seems unlikely that they'll do anything. So I'm sure there are potential for more hiccups, but it looks likely to sail through at the moment.
So what can you tell us about some of the specifics of this deal? You know, you said it was overwhelmingly a positive deal for the UK. Why exactly is that?
So far, this looks like it's the kind of, they were calling it the Canada Plus Plus at the start deal, a deal that's kind of better than the deal Canada got from the European Union when they signed a deal a little bit ago. This is what they were said. This is what Britain was aiming for from the outset. This is what a lot of people said was absolutely impossible, both the kind of the deep staters within the UK, the people in the EU. But this is what it looks like they've pulled off. So Britain will not be in the single market, but they will be able to trade with the European Union in goods with no tariffs and no quotas. So that's a pretty big deal. Almost unlimited trade, no barriers to trade. There might be some regulatory barriers to trade, you know, a few more labels and things like that to certify exactly where products came from than would have to be were Britain remaining in the single market. But in general, that's pretty open. The other kind of big change was that, like we talked about when I last talked about this, Europe wanted to be able to punish Britain for any divergence in EU law. So if EU law got stricter and Britain didn't, the EU wanted to unilaterally be able to impose punitive tariffs. There is a mechanism, but it's much more proportionate now. So rather than the European Union just getting to decide what punishment, what level of punishment, there'll be an international arbitration panel set up that should be neutral. That's where the details will be important. Anyone's analyzed the details of how that panel will be made up. But if they are truly neutral, and then any tariffs must be placed on the product in question. So if it's, say, cars, and there's a difference in regulation on cars, Europe can't retaliate by putting tariffs on British cheese. They could instead only just try to recoup their losses on that one particular product. So it does feel very much like this is what Britain went into Brexit wanting. There are still some compromises. I think Britain didn't get everything they wanted on financial services, for example, which is pretty important. London and the financial industry in London is huge to the British economy. There'll be more avenues, I think, for Europe to try and poach some of that business under the current deal than Britain would have liked. It seems also like Britain compromised on fishing, giving more access to British waters for EU fishermen. But again, you know, Nigel Farage is saying the war is over. The Brexit, I think what he says will carry a lot of weight with a lot of people. And thus far, it does look like Boris Johnson did exactly what he said he would do if he got elected and got Brexit done.
Sounds overall like like a very exciting development. And Brexit is something that the Trumpet has been closely watching for years because of specific prophecies in the Bible. Could you talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, this is a huge aspect of this, that Herbert W. Armstrong forecast that Britain would leave the European Union almost from the day that it joined. We've quoted these words quite a few times because they've proven so prophetic. But he wrote on January 1st, 1973, this date that Britain kind of joined the European Union, that it would be a date fraught with ominous potentialities. It would be a bad thing for Britain. And then he talked about how the European Union would go on to become a close union of 10 nations. And he said very dogmatically, Britain will not be part of it. There was no hedging of his bets there whatsoever. And we've seen both of those forecasts come true. You know, Britain has seen that it was a bad idea to get into the European Union, that it was a date fraught with ominous potentialities, that even getting out of it was quite difficult because of how corrosive that membership had been. And exactly like Mr. Armstrong said, well, we've left. And we're out. And I think this is where the subject just ties in. We had a great Trumpet Daily radio show earlier this morning from Mr. Dwight Falk, who was subbing in for Mr. Stephen Flurry. And this is what he finished up the show talking about, that God rules in the kingdom of men, that God gives these prophecies and it shows us his power, that he's in control. And he even talked about, he went through a whole, had a great video that he played of, I think it was about 10, 15 minutes long, going through Britain's history and the number of ways that God had intervened to ensure that Bible prophecy was fulfilled in Britain's history. And, well, now you see that with the European Union as well. God said it would happen. Mr. Armstrong, based on Bible prophecy, said definitely, this is going to happen. There are all these prophecies that we've talked about. And we have a Trends article, Why the Trumpet Watches the UK's Break from Europe. And that will show you those Bible prophecies. That will explain why Mr. Armstrong made that forecast. But it's a great proof that God rules in the kingdom of men. I think it's, we've got a very dogmatic and potentially even controversial forecast on what's going on with the presidential election. With Donald Trump is going to continue his presidency. Well, Mr. Armstrong said Britain is going to leave the European Union. It's happened, and it's powerful proof of God's command, the authority of the Bible, the importance in the Bible to this modern age and to all of us individually.
It is very powerful to see that prophecy being fulfilled right now so dramatically. And we'll be sure to include a link in our show notes to the article that Richard just mentioned there. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches the UK's Break from Europe. Well, thanks very much for that, Richard. And now we'll take a look at the U.S., where most of the country seems to think that the efforts to have fraudulent votes cast out of the presidential election are basically over. But in reality, this battle is ongoing. And to tell us about the latest, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, the drama over the presidential election just keeps getting greater and greater. With 2 weeks ago, the president giving what he said was the most important speech of his life, exposing voter fraud and really focusing in on two areas. The first area being fraudulent mail-in ballots, and the second being suspicious voting machines. Well, now this week, it looks like some of the companies making that those suspicious voting machines haven't taken too kindly to the claim. A top employee from Dominion Voting Machines is actually suing 14 defendants for defamation, claiming that they have falsely reported that he is at the center of a national conspiracy to fraudulently elect the president of the United States. That lawsuit was filed actually by Eric Coomer, who's the security director at Dominion Voting Machines, and it's accusing the Trump campaign, the conservative blog, the Gateway Pundit, the conservative media company Newsmax, the conservative media company One America News, the activist Joseph Altman, another conservative columnist, Michelle Macklin, Trump's lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, and another American attorney, Sidney Powell. And so that's quite the lineup. And Coomer's main, I think he's the one to file it, is he's the main person he's accusing is Joseph Altman, who claimed that he heard was in on an Antifa call, or a call between Coomer and Antifa members, where Coomer said that I'm going to make sure Trump loses this election. So that was the most direct personal attack that they're focusing in on, where Giuliani and Powell and the Trump campaign have been a little more broad, not necessarily singling out Coomer so much, but just saying that, Giuliani basically phrased it that Dominion's basically this front group for Smartmatic International, which is using software designed by three Venezuelan engineers to rig elections for Hugo Chavez. And so Dominion's saying that's all a conspiracy theory. They're taking them to court for it. And they're very confident. They say that the New York Times is even saying that this court case, they're calling it the Red Slime court case, could be the court case that, like, takes down right-wing media. Basically, it's like, oh, we're not only going to, like, keep Trump out of office, but we're going to, like, shut down the Gateway Pundit, shut down Newsmax, shut down One America News, shut down all these networks who've accused Dominion.
So it sounds like there could really be a lot at stake here if Coomer were successful in this lawsuit.
Yeah, the stakes are really high, and some news outlets have just trying to protect themselves legally have walked back some of their claims slightly, but the Trump campaign hasn't, and Sidney Powell hasn't. She's hired the Georgia attorney Lynn Wood, who we actually talked about on this program a couple weeks ago. To represent her in this case. And Woods basically said that he's like, I'm taking Eric Coomer and Dominion's defamation lawsuit is almost like a panic maneuver. He's like, this is like, I'm over the target. He's like, they're freaking out because I'm getting close.
So you would think that some of these Republicans would be sobered and worried about this, but instead you're describing kind of the opposite. They're saying we're happy to have our day in court, even if it's not on the terms that we expected.
Yeah, you'd think a normal person going into a defamation lawsuit, if they were really just making up baseless claims, would be getting a little nervous, unless they're just like really, really a really really bold liar. But no, they're confident, and there's it's kind of ironic in some way in that Sidney Powell's been, she's had just court case after court case after court case thrown out of court. She's trying to present her evidence, and no one will let her do it. And now Dominion's actually, they sent letters to the White House saying, preserve all your evidence because we might need it to convict her of defamation. So I guess one way or another, it looks like she will get her day in court, and the American people will hear what she has to say.
So do you know when this day in court is supposed to be and if it could possibly be wrapped up before Inauguration Day?
They're looking at January, and I mean, Inauguration Day is towards the end of January. So it's looking like probably early to mid-January they're going to start having court cases, which is, yeah, interesting timing, because that's definitely, well, the article we'll put in the show notes is the one we've put in the show notes for the past several weeks now, is our editor-in-chief's article, Why Donald Trump Will Remain America's President, that goes through prophecies mainly in 2 Kings 14 and Amos 7 about an end-time Jeroboam who leads a temporary resurgence in America, and it explains the details of the things that this leader is going to do, identifies President Trump as this leader, and then shows that these prophecies aren't fulfilled yet, so he must remain in office. Which means that whether it's this particular court case or not, over the next several weeks, we're definitely going to see some dramatic things happen that have never happened before in American history.
We'll be sure to include a link to that article. And Andrew also has an article up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called Dominion Voting Systems Sues Trump Campaign for Defamation. So please check both of those out. Thanks very much for that, Andrew. We'll go next to Israel, where the nation announced that it will soon hold elections once again, setting a record for how many elections will have taken place in such a short time frame. To learn about this one, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Yes, Israel is going to its fourth election in the span of the last 2 years. Of course, a lot of people around the world would be interested in this. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has been ruling for over a decade now. He is the longest serving prime minister, and part of the previous coalition deal that has ended now is that there would be a rotating prime ministership with Benny Gantz, whom he joined in coalition, the Blue and White Party, together with Netanyahu's Likud Party. Well, what would have happened is that after 18 months, Prime Minister Netanyahu would have left office. He would have become the deputy prime minister. However, the one loophole to negate that eventuality from taking place has taken place, and that is that they could not agree on a budget going forward. The budget wasn't the only problem. There was other bickering involved, and so the Knesset has now dissolved, which will leave the government has dissolved, which will leave the prime minister in power through till the election time, which will take place most likely at the end of March. And what's interesting also going around this time around, it will be different because just prior to the dissolution, of the government. Some from the Prime Minister's own party of Likud broke away. Gideon Saar, who has challenged the Prime Minister before in internal primaries inside Likud for power, he broke off, and he's taken with him a number of Likud supporters, or at least they will be part of his new party. His new party is called New Hope, which I think is fitting, given that it's the fourth episode of elections in the past 2 years for all you Star Wars fans out there. And so it looks like, given polling over the last couple of days, Likud would still win the election if it was held today. This New Hope party would be coming in at a close second. However, it looks like Benny Gantz's future is gone. And what most people have been commentating on is that regardless of the iteration of the next Knesset, it is going to be a right-wing government. Most of Israel remains committed to conservative, or at least, let's say, security issues, right, more of the right-wing issues. Does not want some type of horrible peace deal with the Palestinians. They want to continue on the direction that they're going on. However, many just don't like Benjamin Netanyahu. And so you're going to have a bunch of right-wing parties that are voting or coming up for the next election. The left is going to be diminished substantially. However, if one of these other parties on the right that is not Likud, if they are going to become the majority in the Knesset, they will have to join with the left-leaning factions in the eventuation that they have enough seats to oust Netanyahu.
There's a lot for us to keep our eyes on going forward there. And you had a trumpet brief about this yesterday, saying that as much as some are saying that Netanyahu is a threat to Israel's democracy, the real threat to it actually comes from somewhere else.
Yeah, and it's been the dearth in the media about this has been absolutely shocking, but unsurprising. Carolyn Glick just put out a piece about this in the last couple of hours, talking about how across town on the same day that just a short ways away at the High Court, that the Knesset decided that it was going to break up. You had a trial going on at the Supreme Court. And this is Israel's High Court, Supreme Court. It can go by either name. But they were hearing 15 different petitions to the court from groups that disagreed with the legality of a law that was passed back in 2018, known as the nation state law. This is what Israel, the closest thing that Israel has to a constitution are these series of basic laws that it has set up, the nation state law being the latest one of these. It basically says that we are a Jewish state. This is our flag. This is our anthem. Hebrew is our national language, just to set some firm boundaries, given the way that the radical left was moving Israel away from those founding principles and ideals of the country. It seems obvious that Israel is a Jewish state. It probably doesn't need a law. However, that was made a law back in 2018. However, the Supreme Court has decided that it has the power to hear cases regarding the legality of laws that, and as close as Israel has to a constitution, it's sitting in judgment of the constitution of the state of Israel, which is extremely worrying because all the high courts and supreme courts, just like in the United States, their fundamental job is to judge cases based on the laws given to it, based on the constitution given to it by the people, by the legislative branch. And what Israel's High Court has done over the past 35 years has gradually taken more and more and more power to the point that it is now acting as the sovereign power in Israel, the unelected sovereign power in Israel in deciding to hear a case against this nation state law. Now, it has decided that it is not going to intervene and change the nation state law. But the very fact that they are open to interpreting it or judging it shows that they believe they have the power to do so, which is absolutely terrifying for anyone that should believe in democratic rule inside Israel, because this is not a democratic institution. This is a court that gets its power from itself. It is bound by no one if it is not bound by the strongest law given to it by the legislative branch. So this is a worrying trend. It's one that we've written up in our Watch Jerusalem magazine. We even had an article in The Trumpeter about it as well. And the article in the Watch Jerusalem magazine is Israel's Rogue Supreme Court, or something like very similar to that. And it goes through this history. And what we do in it is connect this swing towards a radical interpretation of law, or let's just say lawlessness, of the highest court in the land. We link it back to an event that took place in the United States, actually, in the late 80s, because you had the same attack on law, the fundamental law, the Constitution, the movement towards an evolving Constitution, the way Robert Bork, as he was trying to be admitted to the Supreme Court, how he was attacked, and even though he was an originalist that believed in the Constitution as it was originally written, and Mr. Fleury wrote how that attack on law that took place in 86 and 87 was an indication of the direction of the country in the United States. And here in Israel, we have the same trend playing out to the point now that the High Court is now judging it's Israel's constitution. And on what basis? On the basis that it gives itself, on the rules that it defines it should be judged by. So it's absolutely shocking. It's a turn of event into lawlessness. It does break set a new precedent for the Supreme Court. And this is one of the things that's going to be on the ballot box come March. People in Israel are not happy with this, because if people in Israel were happy with this, the Supreme Court would not have to try and stuff down the throats of Israelis their own values, because those values would be legislated to them. But since there is not a majority of people that support it, the High Court, or the deep state, as the High Court is part of, is coming in to then dictate policy to Israelis. And their enemy number one, of course, is Prime Minister Netanyahu.
Well, that is just a chilling display of lawlessness. We appreciate you bringing us up to speed on that, and we'll be sure to include a link in our show notes to the article that Brent mentioned there, Israel's Rogue Supreme Court, and then Brent's Trumpet brief on this topic is also up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called The Real Threat to Israeli Democracy is Not Netanyahu. So please check that out as well for more details. Thanks very much, Brent. We will take a look now at Japan, which just approved a new defense budget that has many onlookers quite concerned. For this, we'll go to Mihailo Zekic.
Thank you. This Monday, the Japanese cabinet approved Japan's largest defense budget ever at 5.3 trillion yen. That's 51.7 billion U.S. dollars. That's a 0.5% increase over fiscal year 2020, which is actually less than what the Japanese defense ministry wanted. They wanted a 3.5% increase. This would be Japan's ninth year in a row of increasing its defense budget. And it's also the first defense budget approved under Japan's new prime minister, Yoshihide Suga. Suga took over after his predecessor, Shinzo Abe, resigned earlier this year due to ill health. But while he is a new man, he is considered to be one of Shinzo Abe's closest associates and has vowed to continue in Abe's legacy, including the revision of Article 9 of Japan's constitution, which technically forbids Japan from participating in military activity. Abe was unsuccessful at getting rid of it, but Suga might have some different luck. The budget now has to be approved by the Diet. Suga's party, the Liberal Democratic Party, has a majority, so that's likely to happen.
What can you tell us about some of the specific items that Japan will be bringing online as a result of this increase in funding?
Well, for one thing, they have $555 million reserved for the development and construction of the FX, which will be Japan's first domestic fighter jet since 1975. It is a joint project between Mitsubishi and Lockheed Martin, and it's a pretty impressive jet just from the plans. It will be outfitted with missiles for intended to target land, air, and sea targets. It will have an upgraded stealth system, and it even has weaponized radar that can fry incoming enemy missiles. It's anticipated to outperform America's F-25 fighter jets and to be on par with equivalent planes in the Russian and Chinese air forces. There's also $1.1 billion earmarked for space warfare, of all things. One particular piece of technology Japan has in mind is a telescope capable of detecting hypersonic weapons like the kinds China and Russia are working on right now. Such weapons are harder to locate and intercept than traditional ballistic missiles. There'll be $289 million reserved for two new cybersecurity units and $27 million earmarked for to develop a laser that can shoot down drones.
Quite an impressive laundry list there of military, you know, hardware and everything else that Japan will be acquiring. Could you let the listeners know a little about Japan's history that really makes this week's announcement so alarming?
Well, of course, on the surface, you'd think that this would be pretty good news. Japan's an American ally. It's a vital trade partner. It's one of the few stable democracies in that part of the world. But some historical associations make this especially troubling. Take, for example, Article 9 itself. The Japanese didn't adopt it willingly. It was put on them by American occupying forces at the end of World War II. Japan, of course, committed some of the most violent and atrocious crimes in World War II. Things come to mind like the Rape of Nanjing, the Bataan Death March, the use of Korean comfort women. And the American occupying forces wanted to make sure that something like that never happened again. The article essentially forbids Japan from having land, sea, and air forces, and even the capacity to declare war. However, one sentence in that article says that Japan can't use war, quote, as a means of settling international disputes, unquote. Japan has the leeway using that phrase to interpret the Constitution as banning offensive but not defensive warfare. And the Japanese government has taken the idea of self-defense quite liberally. Today, it has the fifth most powerful military in the world, according to Global Firepower. It has a navy larger than Britain's and France's combined. It has soldiers in international military bases as far away as Bahrain and the Persian Gulf and Djibouti and the Horn of Africa. And the big question with this is, if Japan already has this and America has given it the quiet go-ahead to do this, why are they so urgent to get rid of Article 9? The only thing I can think of is that they're hoping on increasing Japan's military presence elsewhere to settle international disputes and perhaps like do things that normally that wouldn't be in any way considered purely defensive.
Yes, and could you put this in the context of Bible prophecy briefly for us, please?
Of course. In the book of Revelation, you have a interesting power block in called the Kings of the East. That's mentioned in chapter 16, verse 12. Now, the key takeaway here is kings. It's going to be a block of more than one country. And Revelation 9:16 brings out that this power block will field an army of 200 million soldiers. That is an astronomical amount. And, of course, keep in mind, east in this context means east of the Holy Land. So what countries east of the Middle East could field an army that big? Well, it's obviously giants of Asia. There's China and India both have over a billion people, and they could very well field an army this size. Japan has significantly less than that, but still a pretty large population. And unique to Japan is that they've have years and decades of experience in the technological sector, and they have a technological advantage that most other countries do not have. I mean, with some of the weapons I was talking about, leave it to the Japanese to have that kind of fun with technology. And their history in World War II has shown that they can be extremely aggressive. They can punch well above their weight in battle. And we definitely expect Japan to be a part of this conglomerate.
Mihailo has an article up on thetrumpet.com right now. It's called Made in Japan, a Defense Budget Fit for an Emperor. So please check that out at thetrumpet.com for more details. And we will also link in our show notes to Russia and China in Prophecy, our free booklet, and an article called Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism. Thanks very much for that, Mihailo. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. We'll take a short break, and then coming up, we'll look at a major cyber attack on some of America's most sensitive systems, a rocket attack on an American embassy, neo-Nazism in Germany, and another milestone in Russia's and China's military partnership. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
New reports say that over the last few months, America has been suffering one of its most serious and prolonged cyber attacks. To talk about this, we'll go back to Andrew.
On December 13th, Reuters reported that hackers had broken into the networks of several federal agencies, including the State Department, the Justice Department, the Treasury, and the Department of Energy. And this week, the Wall Street Journal revealed that the hack was actually bigger than they originally thought, even including several U.S. companies, technology companies like Cisco Systems, Intel Core, and VMware Inc. Now, these hackers inserted malicious code into some network software from a company in Austin called SolarWinds Core. This happened in March, and the software was delivered to 18,000 customers, including all the entities I just mentioned, and even entities overseas in the British government and elsewhere. And yet it took nine months of people using this software with this malicious code, allowing people to spy on the companies using it through the back door before we found out it was happening. And so some people are even calling this potentially the biggest cyber attack in American history. It was pretty devastating. They're still looking into the details of who did it. The most common answer is the institution called Cozy Bear. That's a Kremlin-linked cyber group that's tried to hack the U.S. government in the past. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Attorney General Bill Barr agreed that Russia was the most likely perpetrator of the attack, although President Trump has stressed, with all the new revelations coming out about Chinese espionage in the United States, that China's a potential suspect as well. The most cybersecurity analysts list Russia, China, and Cuba as the three biggest cyber espionage threats to the United States.
And these kinds of attacks are something that the Trumpet has been warning about for a long time.
Yeah, that's the one thing that usually catches my attention is that it's like really early, back in like 1995 when some of these computer systems were just first getting online. Our editor-in-chief wrote an editorial in The Trumpet entitled America's Achilles Heel, where he drew attention that this cyber computer dependency is like America's big weak spot. He phrased it, computer dependency is the Western world's Achilles heel. And within a few years, this weakness could be tested to the full. And then drew attention to a sobering prophecy in Ezekiel 7, verse 14, that says, they've blown the trumpet even to make ready, but none goes to battle, for my wrath is upon the multitude thereof. And this verse is in regards to the end-time descendants of ancient Israel, America, and Britain primarily, and it's talking about a time when the trumpet of war is blown, and it seems like people are expecting the military to mobilize for battle, but that doesn't happen. No one goes to war. And Mr. Fleury makes the suggestion that could well be because of some sort of cyber attack that's shut down military communication systems or even looking at other potentialities, I mean, shutting down nuclear deterrence or or logistics chain, something that basically cripples America's ability to respond to a war. And we're starting to see these cyber attacks getting bigger and bigger and bigger against the United States. This this most recent one really underscores the potential for that America's Achilles heel moment.
Andrew has an article up on thetrumpet.com. It's called Solar Winds Hack Underscores America's Achilles Heel, and it goes through those prophecies. We will include a link to that in the show notes for today's program, so please check that out, and thanks very much, Andrew. Well, while America was under a cyber attack, it was also under a missile attack at its embassy in Baghdad, Iraq. To bring us up to speed on this, we'll go once again to Brenton Octagon.
Yes, on Sunday, eight rockets were launched at the United States Embassy inside Iraq. This is the location of numerous attacks, actually, in the past year, but the most famous one of those and the riots that took place in front of the embassy back a year ago precipitated the death of Qasem Soleimani, the head of Iran's Quds Force. 2020 has been an absolutely crazy year, and it seems like the events surrounding the Baghdad airport and the U.S. Embassy inside Baghdad were very central to setting off 2020 in a very bad way. And it seems like we're warming up for 2021 in the same fashion. You've had these rockets that were fired from somewhere close. Of course, there has been no culprit that has been designated by the Iraqis. And the reason for that is that a lot of the Iraqi leadership are in bed with Iran. And we have talked about this for decades now, it seems. But these rocket attacks are coming so often against U.S. Interests. In response to the attack, there was several of these anti-missile defenses that were set off, and they knocked out a couple of these missiles from the sky. One of them did penetrate. One person was killed. However, that was not an American. U.S. Personnel at the Baghdad embassy is actually diminished because of the United States' position that Iraq is allowing Iran too much power inside its country, and it forms most of this power through the popular mobilization units, or the PMF forces, they could be called. These are Shiite militias that Iran has controlled, most of them that Iran controls, some of them that Iran doesn't. However, they have now do form part of the armed forces of the Iraqis, but they answer to Iran. And even some of the major political parties inside Baghdad's parliament answer to Iran and are more loyal to Iran than they are to the Iraqi state. And so America finds itself in a very dangerous situation. The United States president, he tweeted out following the attack this, Donald Trump said this, our embassy in Baghdad got hit Sunday by several rockets. Guess where they came from? Iran. And he showed proof of the rockets that were used, which were definitely made in Iran. Now we hear, he says, President Trump continued, now we hear chatter of additional attacks against Americans in Iraq. Some friendly advice to Iran, if one American is killed, I will hold Iran responsible, think it over. And there was an American contractor at the end of 2019 that was killed in an Iranian strike of an American base outside of Baghdad. And then the president responded, taking out their spy master in chief, their terrorist in chief, the very man that organizes such attacks similar to this all over the Middle East, Qasem Soleimani. And Iran's response from that was quite muted. But why? Probably because they knew President Trump would respond harshly if more Americans were killed. And you remember that Trump said, if you attack and Americans get killed in your response, watch out. No Americans were killed in Iran's retaliation. Yet over the past week, Ayatollah Khamenei, the ruler of Iran, has said that Iran has not responded sufficiently to the death of Qasem Soleimani. And so are we going to see in the next few days a welcome president, as Iran would see it for a president-elect, as many Americans would see it for Joe Biden? It looks like we might. The United States right now is preparing for this. We had on Monday, a day after this, we've had the USS Georgia, which is a submarine that's capable of firing cruise missiles, entered the Persian Gulf. This hasn't happened for a decade, one of these type of vessels to come in. There's rumors that Israel actually has one of its submarines in the Persian Gulf right now. America just shipped a bunch of B-52s, flew in a bunch of B-52 bombers to the region 2 weeks ago. And so it looks like President Trump could be preparing for retaliation against a strike from Iran, but we'll have to see.
Where would you send listeners who would like to know more about this in the prophetic context?
Well, Callum Wood has a good article up right now, published today, Rocket Attack Strikes U.S. Embassy. It goes into some of the history here. It also talks about the prophetically how we do expect Iran to chase out the United States from Iraq. And I think the United States right now recognizes that it cannot win Iraq. It is trying to find ways of diminishing more of its personnel from its Baghdad embassy and ways of protecting those that remain. And so that is what we expect to happen based on Mr. Flurry's book, The King of the South, which is based on prophecies found in the book of Daniel. And Mr. Flurry has talked about Iraq falling to Iran since 1994. So this is a long-term prophecy that we've expected. This was before the surge when you had hundreds of thousands of U.S. servicemen there. And yet here we are 2020, nearly 2021. It looks like that's going to be the case.
We'll be sure to include links to Mr. Callum Wood's article, Rocket Attack Strikes U.S. Embassy, and also to Mr. Fleury's booklet, The King of the South, in the show notes. So please check those out for more details on this important story. Thanks very much for that, Brent. For the next story, we'll go take a look at Germany, where reports show that far-right extremism among police is far more common than we would like to think. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, just over the last week or two, there have been a number of reports, both in the English language press and the German press, on far-right extremism within the German police. I thought the New York Times' title was particularly effective. She called the police over a neo-Nazi threat, but the neo-Nazis were inside the police. You know, for many of these people, they're used to relying on the police to protect them from neo-Nazis, but increasingly you're getting people targeted by neo-Nazis, and these neo-Nazis are getting their addresses, they're getting the contact details, they're getting in touch with people by using police databases. And this article starts and kind of centers around a woman of Turkish descent who was receiving messages, you know, very insulting messages, basically say, you know, insulting her and saying that they're going to kill her daughter, and being signed off on as coming from a particularly infamous neo-Nazi group. And she's not the only one. This kind of thing has become pretty common with accusations of addresses coming from police databases. There's been a whole history of neo-Nazis being found in police forces. So back in September in the state of Nordrhein-Westphalia, you had several officers suspended for organizing a far-right online group chats where they would share pictures of swastikas and migrants in gas chambers. A similar chat room the next month with 25 officers in the Berlin police department, one saying, well, you know, is your entrance exam to get into the Berlin police? You should be forced to shoot six illegal immigrants. Last month, there were 15 policemen from the city of Essen. They were suspended again for this kind of far-right content. And this isn't new. The reports are new. There have been a few reports, like I said, coming out over the last couple of weeks. But it's part of a pattern of reports that goes back really decades, especially to the early 1990s. But you just see this kind of ebb and flow where there's a lot of evidence that the far right have infiltrated into police forces, infiltrated into the army, into the intelligence agencies, and at quite a high level.
And this is something that really shows how relevant the Bible's prophecies about Germany are.
Yes, exactly. We talked in the first half about a very specific forecast Herbert W. Armstrong made about Brexit. And this is another example, I think, of a very specific forecast Herbert W. Armstrong made because of Bible prophecy that we've now seen proven true. I mean, he, right from the end of World War II, he's talked about how Nazis have gone underground, and that they've gone and they've worked to infiltrate these different departments, and they've disappeared from view, but a lot of them are still there. And we have seen in the last couple of decades all kinds of declassified material showing that he was right to a really shocking extent. You know, you've had German government department after German government department come out and say, yeah, we were thoroughly infiltrated by neo-Nazis after World War II. And you had, you know, the police and you had the intelligence agencies and the army cover up for neo-Nazis on the run. You had all kinds of people pretending that they had nothing to do with Hitler's regime when actually they were instrumental to its running. And there have been thousands of pages of documents put out by the German government. You've had incident after incident within Germany's army, within the special forces, especially that's something we've talked about a fair bit this year, within Germany's foreign and domestic intelligence services, where they've been funneling money to neo-Nazi groups, where for one case there was an agent in the same room as some neo-Nazi murders, and she pretended not to notice, and we still don't really know what's going on there. A thorough infiltration, exactly the way Mr. Armstrong talked about. And the reason why he made that forecast, again, is because it's based on Bible prophecy. The Bible talks about this empire with a constant spirit, a constant way of operating that has gone underground, and it even uses that word underground, and that it will be back and it will be rising. And what we're seeing in some of these news stories is signs that that empire is rising. And we have an article in the August 2019 Trumpet print edition, The Nazi Underground Revealed, that will take you through what Mr. Armstrong wrote and will show you how that is based on Bible prophecy.
The Nazi Underground Revealed. We will be sure to include a link to that in our show notes for today's program. And then we'll also have an article going up on thetrumpet.com sometime next week. It's called Neo-Nazism and the German Police. So please keep your eye out for that one next week. And thanks very much for that, Richard. For our final main story today, we'll head back over to Asia to take a look at some provocative new evidence of the quickly deepening Russia-China military partnership. But before that, Mihailo will give us a brief update about the new COVID bailout package here in the United States.
Yes, so on Monday, Congress approved the latest COVID-19 bailout package. It's 5,593 pages long, the bill is. It took 3 hours to print, and both the House of Representatives and the Senate voted on it the same day. So no one really was expected to look through it in its entirety. The package contains $900 billion, which almost doubles the deficit for fiscal year 2021. Now, the interesting thing about this is that the combined sum of direct checks, small business stimulus, vaccine research, and unemployment benefits only add up to $666 billion. Where's the rest going? Well, in reality, this bill has a lot more to do than just helping people survive the COVID lockdown. This is one big, fat omnibus bill and contains a lot of funding for a lot of really bizarre things, especially in the realm of foreign affairs. Now, all this kind of stuff begs the question, why aren't we using this from the regular budget? Why are we using a special bailout package for this? And it's really ridiculous on how all this is going on. But to go back to Asia, on Tuesday, Russia and China had a joint bomber patrol over the Sea of Japan and East China Sea. According to Russia's defense military, Russia had two Tu-095 strategic bombers flying in the exercises, while China had four H-6K bombers. Now, that's what Russia's defense ministry says. South Korea, whose territory was violated by this exercise, had a different report to give. They gave a total report of 15 Russian aircraft, as well as the four Chinese, and all 19 of the aircraft entered South Korea's air defense identification zone. This also scared Japan to mobilize its air force in response. Russia's defense ministry said that the patrol wasn't directed against any third countries, but the Russian government has also said that they're not in Ukraine right now, so anything they should say should be taken with a pinch of salt. This is really huge. This follows on the heels of what was in September, the largest military exercise in history between Russia, China, and a few other Asian nations. And this is just so representative of the budding Russian-Chinese partnership that we're seeing forming. They see a common enemy in the West and in other foes, and so they're growing together increasingly. Russian President Vladimir Putin in October, when he was asked about a Russo-Chinese alliance, he said, quote, "Our relations have reached such a level of cooperation and trust it is not necessary, but it is certainly imaginable. We are not going to rule it out," unquote. Now, A lot of people were focusing on the fact that Putin said China and Russia might come in alliance. But the big thing about this is he's basically saying we already have an alliance in all but name. We don't need a formal piece of paper to formalize this. And this latest military exercise against Japan, as we have just heard, who is a not a military lightweight of itself, shows that you're seeing these two Asian behemoths really get together and create a power block that is frankly terrifying.
Yeah, seeing these two draw close, especially militarily, it really does bring the prophecies of the Bible alive in a powerful way, which listeners could understand if they order a free copy of our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy. And we'll be sure to include a link to that in the show notes for today's program. I'm Jeremiah Jacques. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks very much to our panel, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, Mihailo Zekic, and Brent Noctegal. And I'll leave you today with the words of Khalil Gibran. Work is love made visible. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
To Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.